Across the Lone Star State, Texans expected to be tuning in tonight for political fireworks. But what about policies? Setting the stage for a final debate today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. Texans looking for unemployment benefits will soon have to once again prove they are looking for work. But what constitutes a work search in the eyes of Texas officials? We'll take a closer look. In Collin County, it's the academy versus free speech as a professor's tweet roils a college campus. A freeze frame on a music scene almost forgotten from 40 years back. And fake news for real? A warning about a rising force in local news that has experts advising don't believe everything you read. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this Thursday, October 22nd. I'm David Brown. A developing story in El Paso, where officials now report an all-time high of COVID-19 cases, a spike of more than 1,100 new cases, and four additional deaths yesterday. That brings the total number of active cases to almost 9,500 in El Paso County, with more than 570 patients hospitalized and 73 on ventilators. All the data is pointing the same direction when it comes to explaining this surge. According to the El Paso Times, adults in their 20s and 30s appear to have contracted the virus while out in public and not taking the proper safety precautions, not wearing masks, not being cooperative with contact tracers, continuing to host or attend house parties and social gatherings. Officials in El Paso have scheduled an update for this afternoon. Keep it here for the latest. Amid the chaos wrought by COVID, a calm conversation about next steps might be nice, but there will be none of that in Nashville, as President Trump and former Vice President Joseph Biden meet for their second and final presidential debate. It'll be broadcast basically everywhere, beginning at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain Time. The time zone Richard Panetta is using to tune in tonight. He's the director of the Sam Donaldson Center for Communication Studies at the University of Texas at El Paso. Professor Panetta, welcome back to The Standard.
Great to be here, David.
You know, I am thinking that this will be the last time voters will get to see the two candidates together on stage. And I think the first question that a lot of people are asking is, will this really matter? I mean, at this point, haven't most voters made up of their minds?
I think that's right, David. I think tonight's debate is probably one of incredibly low stakes, but one with heightened expectations. I think we are going to tune in, even though we know who we are voting for. And I think it's a little bit about confirmation, and it's a little bit, I think, in hopes that we will see some fireworks tonight.
That's interesting. So what you're saying is even though many people aren't expecting to be swayed one way or another, it's likely to draw a huge viewership.
I think when you get an invitation to a train wreck, David, it's very hard to avoid sitting front row. And I think that's what America gets tonight.
It's hard not to laugh about your description there of a train wreck. But at the same time, there's something tragic about this. I mean, it is the fact that we're not talking about the policies that are likely to be covered. We should talk about these issues, of course. But the fact that we're talking about the train wreck element of it, does it reflect democracy or does it reflect the state of democracy in 2020 in the United States? Or are we talking about something more superficial here?
I do think that it reflects poorly on where we are as a country, just in terms of what our expectations are. And I think you're right. I think there needs to be some conversations about policy. I think what you're going to see tonight, the president has been in this position before. And in 2016, in the last debate with Secretary Clinton, there was some of the same concern that he wasn't going to be able to maintain message discipline and that he was going to sort of go off the rails as he had in the first debate with Secretary Clinton. So you can see some parallels very clearly. I think tonight the president is likely to temper himself a little bit, but I think that the problem is that over the course of this last week, you've seen, I think, what we're going to hear tonight. Lots of references to Hunter Biden. You'll hear references to the economy absent the conversation about COVID-19. And if the president's wise, he'll talk about the nomination coming out of committee today for their nominee to the Supreme Court. But on the other side, side of this, Vice President Biden has a much, much lower set of expectations. He's proven to be fairly stable in debates. I think the town hall last week was a good example of that. So the question or the issue in front of the vice president is don't take the bait on Hunter Biden and stick to the same message, COVID-19, COVID-19, COVID-19.
Well, in fact, in places like where you are right now, COVID-19 is not yesterday's concern. In fact, we're seeing the numbers spike tremendously over the past 24 to 48 hours, a real concern. And when you've got coronavirus as one of the announced topics tonight, you've got issues of race in the United States, you've got issues of climate change and energy security, for example, all of these issues huge for the Lone Star State. Is it hoping, wishing for too much that we won't have any of these topics addressed in any substance?
I think it might be, David, and I think the reason is because at least with COVID-19, it's not only the sort of major political issue that overhangs this election, but one thing that I think will be important for folks to think about is that tonight's debate does reflect on some of the down ballot races, and I think the Republican Party is very nervous about how the president handles these issues, largely because there are a number of Republicans who potentially could become vulnerable or are vulnerable, and I think that's the other issue about message discipline. So, you know, this could be a chance to talk about the success of policies. But I think so far in these events over the course of the last several days, the president has not been on point about the virus. And so I think if Vice President Biden is smart, if his team has prepped him well, I think that's what he hammers on, David. He comes back to it. Anytime the president talks about the state of the economy, the vice president says that's all well and good, but we're having a crisis right now. If he talks about international relations, the vice president should pivot back to COVID-19 and how that's affecting our position globally. I think it's the vice president has such a low set of expectations to be able to meet tonight that I think that it really does fall in the president's court to come out much stronger than the first debate.
Richard Pineda is director of the Sam Donaldson Center for Communication Studies at the University of Texas at El Paso. Professor, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us again on the Texas Standard. We appreciate your expertise.
You're welcome, David.
Last spring, the Texas Workforce Commission suspended requirements to search for work during the pandemic. They're now reinstating the work search requirements starting November 1st. If Texans receiving unemployment benefits don't do this, they risk losing those benefits. What exactly does the TWC mean, though, by work search? Here to talk about it, James Burnson. He is the agency's Deputy Director of Communications. Welcome to the Texas Standard, James.
Great to be here.
Why is the agency reinstating the work search requirement now? I mean, listeners may say, well, look, we're still in a pandemic, right?
Well, first of all, work search is a federal requirement for unemployment insurance. And it was suspended because at the time, it made no sense to require people to search for work when businesses weren't even open. And so what we're seeing now that businesses are opening and businesses have found out ways to work at socially distancing, having people work from home, the job opportunities are out there. And this is the appropriate time to bring back work search.
So what will jobless Texans need to do to prove they're looking for a job under terms of the TWC?
Well, there's a number of activities that count as work search. Not all of them are actually searching for work, although that's the prime focus. Simply registering on workintexas.com, for example, is one work search activity. You can search for jobs on workintexas.com or other job sites, or you can do things like you can go to a workforce development office around the state. We have 180 of these, and you can work with them to work on your resume or to look for job opportunities there. You can attend a virtual job fair, or you can even take training that we have available through several vendors.
Is there a certain time period that you need to be, say, furloughed or laid off that make it so that you have to meet this requirement? In other words, if you've been furloughed by your employer, do you also have to show that you're looking for a job, even if your employer is saying, well, when things get back to normal, we'll bring you back on?
Well, if your business has a definite return to work date that is within 12 weeks of the layoff, then you're exempt from the work search. If your re- turn to work date is beyond 12 weeks, that can result in a waiver of work search at the discretion of TWC. You can certainly inform us and we can consider that as possibly exempting you.
For some listeners, their own business basically put food on the table. What do you tell business owners in a situation like this? Do they also have to show they're searching for a job?
Yes, that's a good question, because normally people who are self-employed would not qualify for unemployment benefits anyway, but because of the CARES Act and certain changes to deal with the pandemic, that has been extended to them. So for people who are self-employed, they would have to show some sort of activity to bring their business back. And that would almost be in a case-by-case basis, but they can document that activity and submit that in place of work search, and that would qualify for them.
What's the latest figure on claims right now? Do we have a sort of a high water mark that we reached? And when did that happen?
Certainly in April and May was our high water mark period of job claims. And we've seen that the number of new claims has gone down significantly since then. Essentially, in the last 7 months, we had 3 years of unemployment claims. But what we've also seen is a big turnaround in the unemployment numbers. Of course, this latest month, it went up a little bit. But in general, we've come down from 13% to right now just over 8%. So we've seen opportunities return, and we're definitely seeing signs that Texans want to get out there and get back to work.
James Burnson is Deputy Director of Communications for the Texas Workforce Commission. James, thanks for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And by the way, we'll have a link over at texasstandard.org to resources for those wanting to find out more about the requirements for work search.
Wells Dunbar is our social media editor, and he's been keeping up with the talk of Texas. Wells, what are you hearing?
Well, as we've been hearing here on the show, that final presidential debate happens tonight, and folks are eager to see how this one plays out. On our Facebook page, Jeremy Remy Gardner says he's curious to see how that mute button plays out. Should be interesting to see if that gets some airtime or whether or not it gets activated there during the debate. And you know, David, something you touched on a few moments ago in that interview, that massive spike in COVID-19 cases in El Paso definitely has folks concerned. Mario Modesto notes the occurrence of over 1,000 new COVID-19 positive cases in El Paso yesterday. Similarly, on our Facebook page, John Davis notes that puts the city at close to 3,000 so far this week. So obviously, lots of thoughts and hopeful feelings going out there to our friends and listeners in El Paso, a story we're continuing to watch. It's just one of many we're continuing to watch on social media. So I'll be back with more reactions later in the show.
Yes, indeed. We would love to know what, if anything in particular, you are looking for in tonight's presidential debate. You can reach out to Texas Standard at your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you. He's going to be joining us again in about 35 minutes with more of the Talk of Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In Plano, a Collin College professor's message posted on Twitter has drawn fire from the school's president. He's calling the professor's remarks hateful and vile. As KERA's Bill Zeeble reports, the issue is sparking a debate over academia and free speech.
Collin College history professor Laura Burnett was watching the vice presidential debate, and she said she was bothered that Vice President Mike Pence kept talking past his allotted time, despite repeated requests to stop. So she posted a comment on Twitter.
That's what I became infamous for, was saying that Mike Pence should shut his little demon mouth.
Her tweet got picked up by the conservative news site Campus Reform, and she says she warned her college administration there might be some fallout. Fox News then grabbed the story.
All weekend, I received various messages on various media, calling me the C word, the B word, telling me to F off, calling me a commie feminazi, and privileged millennial, which was very flattering since I'm in my 50s.
Collin College says it's received complaints, emails, and voicemails, as well as contacts from legislators. District President Neil Matkin distributed an email referring to the post, that demon mouth comment, as hateful, vile, and ill-considered. Burnett was stunned.
My college chose to be both reactionary and also to be repressive and chilling.
Collin College posted a statement online, apologizing for the professor's comments and saying her views, quote, were not conveyed in any manner we wish members of our faculty and staff to express themselves. Without naming her, the statement says Burnett's views weren't consistent with the values of the college. The statement goes on to say that while free expression is a cherished right guaranteed by the Constitution, that does not lessen individual responsibility to protect such rights through care and consideration. Before the letter, Burnett expected she might hear from administrators showing that care and consideration, especially after she gave them a heads up.
No one from the college reached out to me, checked in to see, are you okay? Are you safe?
And she says no one from the college administration defended her free speech rights. KERA asked Collin College to elaborate on the statement. A spokesperson said the college has no further comment at this time.
The institution needs to take the lead in educating people to say, you know, the First Amendment protects this kind of speech.
That's Adam Steinbaugh, an attorney with FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education.
The First Amendment not only prevents the institution from taking action here, but it's a good thing that we're not able to take action here, because otherwise that would imperil speech of all views.
Jonathan Friedman, who heads PEN America's Free Speech Project, said there's no prohibition on saying offensive things about elected officials just by the job you have.
That is why it's so important that universities and colleges demonstrate to the public how to uphold the values of academic and free speech, even when it is difficult, even when people disagree about whether, you know, what someone said is offensive or beyond the pale.
Burnett says the whole experience has left her disappointed. Disappointed by her college's letter, and disappointed for her colleagues because she says they're scared. I'm Bill Zeebel in Dallas.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The vacuum left in many communities by the death of local newspapers hasn't remained empty. Instead, networks of websites with local-sounding names are paying writers to craft stories that favor specific political candidates and messages. According to a story in the New York Times this week, the largest of these networks, whose focus is conservative politics, has a major Texas connection. Here to tell us more about all this, our tech expert Omar Gayaga. Omar, welcome.
Thanks for having me, David.
What's the story here? Are we talking about new local newspapers that aren't really local newspapers? What's this about?
Minus the paper and minus the news, I guess. This was a big investigation in the New York Times. And I mean, we've all seen this. I think, you know, anyone with a Facebook account and eccentric friends has seen, you know, these weird stories that pop up. It's very biased, very extreme stories. And they seem to come from a legitimate news site. You go to the website and it looks like the front page of a small newspaper or a small town publication. But it turns out that a lot of these are fake. A lot of these are websites that are sprung from whole cloth, part of this large network called MediaMetric that started in 2015 by a former TV news reporter. So they have names like the Des Moines Sun, the Ann Arbor Times, the Empire State Today. I mean, they sound legitimate, but they are full of misinformation, bias. They're full of kind of paid-to-play articles, which is when someone pays to have a news story written to their specifications and bias.
I was intrigued when I read the story as well. I'm curious about the Texas nexus here. This reporter this ex-TV reporter who started this enterprise is not a Texan himself, but he's reached out to a Texas consultant?
Yeah, there's a Texas PR consultant named Bradley Cameron who has a company called SMG Strategy based right here in Austin with offices in other cities. And that person is listed as the general manager of MediaMetric. Although all of these websites do not transparently say they are part of MediaMetrics. Some of them, you go to their about page and they don't even have any ownership listed, but they are part of this large network of websites that this person, Brian Timpone, the former TV news reporter, began.
I guess this takes fake news to a new level, although some would say, well, there are plenty of legitimate operations out there that seem to show political, indeed partisan bias all the time. You know, the typical ones are Fox and MSNBC, and there's endless talk about them. What makes this any different from some other news outlet that seems to take a partisan edge?
Yeah, I mean, anyone can, any publisher in any small town can start their own publication and do put whatever they want in it. You know, they can, you know, hire whoever they like and run whatever they want. I mean, that's freedom of the press. But what we're seeing here is a little bit different. It's people paying for specific articles and that money going to reporters who may not even know, you know, who they're writing this for, being paid $20, $30 an article to, you know, fed sources, fed information. A lot of it is against specific political targets. There was the candidate running against Susan Collins in Maine. A whole series of articles were written and paid for just to smear that other candidate. This is happening in South Carolina with articles promoting Lindsey Graham, in Missouri with articles promoting Roy Blunt. Clients were paying something like $2,000 for five articles at a time, and largely just to smear other candidates or to kind of promote a pet issue. That's kind of where it's different from traditional news, is that that's not how newsrooms work.
On the other hand, there are those news outlets which seem to definitely have a partisan slant. Any tips for ways that readers can tell if a site or story they're reading is a legitimate journalistic news source or not? I mean, from whatever side of the aisle.
It gets harder and harder to tell. I mean, the websites we're seeing are getting more sophisticated, and they're designed and made to look like other websites to mimic the design of another site, so you're confused about whether it's the real one or not. A lot of times it's just the content itself. If the content itself seems weird and fishy and not very well edited and very, very biased, it's probably coming from a fake website. You can check the about page on a website, but sometimes that's going to lead you nowhere. It'll give you false information or not tell you anything. There is a website called AllSides.com. That's a good place to check for media bias. They go through different news websites and kind of tell you kind of which way they lean, conservative or progressive, and so forth. But if it's not even on there, I wouldn't trust it.
A lot of fake news out there. Beware. Omar Gayaga covers all things tech at TechMinuteTexas.com. Omar, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, David. Be careful what you read out there.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. To aid early detection, all women over the age of 40 should undergo routine screening, like yearly mammograms. More at TexasOncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. After voting in favor of Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court today, Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn blasted his Democratic colleagues on the Judiciary Committee for not showing up.
I just want to comment on the pictures that are in their chairs, like this is some sort of sporting event during COVID-19, and rather than show up and do their job, they choose to continue the theater that was part of the hearing.
Democrats boycotted the vote to protest confirming Barrett less than 2 weeks before Election Day. Texas Senator Ted Cruz joined fellow Republicans in advancing her nomination to the full Senate. Bexar County is one of the largest in Texas so far to let bars operate at 50% capacity under the governor's COVID-19 guidelines. Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission spokesperson Chris Porter says now more than half of all counties have reopened bars since last week, but they still must comply with health protocols.
We'll see situations where customers might be crowded around a bar top or crowded on a dance floor or in front of a concert stage, those kinds of places where obviously the close proximity and the added crowds could provide a greater risk of infection for the COVID-19 virus.
Porter says 1,300 inspections over the first weekend of reopenings netted 6 license suspensions for violations. More than 120,000 HEB employees will get a $500 bonus. TPR's Lauren Terrazas has more.
All full-time, part-time, hourly, and salaried employees will receive the bonus, which the company is calling a Texas-sized thank you. That includes those who work in stores, manufacturing, warehousing and transportation positions, and administration offices. Employees at Central Market, Mi Tienda, and Joe V's locations will also be eligible for the one-time bonus, as well as favor team members. HEB President Craig Boyan reflected on this year's challenges in a statement and praised the company's workforce for their, quote, grace, compassion, strength, and resilience. I'm Lauren Terrazas in San Antonio.
Two airlines headquartered in Texas are today reporting billions of dollars in losses during the third quarter as conditions for the industry remain bleak amid the pandemic. American Airlines CEO Doug Parker discussed how the Fort Worth-based carrier fared on a conference call this morning.
Our third quarter pre-tax loss, excluding net special items, was $3.6 billion. Our revenues were down 73% year over year.
Southwest Airlines reports a third quarter net loss of $1.2 billion. The Dallas-based company also says it will begin putting passengers back in middle seats December 1st. I'm Joseph Leahy.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron, Adler, Clough, and Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. There are currently thousands of asylum seekers stuck indefinitely in Mexico waiting for U.S. courts to reopen so their requests for asylum can be heard. All this week, we're featuring voices from people caught in this limbo living in Ciudad Juarez across the border from El Paso. It's a reporting project called The Asylum Trap. COVID hasn't just pushed back asylum seekers' court dates. It's also made supporting themselves almost impossible. Today, KERA's Mallory Falk reports on a group providing a makeshift lifeline for those families.
Steering carefully, Will Rocky maneuvers a van across the bridge from El Paso, Texas, into Mexico.
We're about to cross into Ciudad Juarez. We've got a list of families today who have reached out to us asking for dispensas.
The back seats are removed, making room for supplies Rocky and colleague Lindy Morrison will pick up and deliver today. Eggs, beans, baby formula.
Oh, and we're also picking someone up for a dentist appointment this morning.
They make these deliveries a few times a week to asylum seekers living outside of shelters.
Some of them have children, some are just single adults who have lost their jobs. Just a lot of people battling right now due to the pandemic.
Rocky first heads to a dusty neighborhood on the outskirts of Juarez. Children play out front of a small cinder block house.
They contacted us a few days ago saying they pretty much have no food and also asking for some diapers and some...
A woman comes out in a striped shirt and surgical mask, her long dark hair in a high ponytail. She asks us not to use her name since her asylum case is still pending.
Ya tenemos más de un año de estar aquí.
She says her family's been in Juarez for more than a year after fleeing persecution in Honduras. They recently started renting this house. They're comfortable here. They get along with the landlord.
Sentimos bien aquí.
Before the pandemic, Rocky and Morrison probably wouldn't have met her because they mostly worked in shelters. When the Trump administration started sending asylum seekers back over the border into Mexico, they founded a small nonprofit called Seguimos Adelante. They thought they were reaching a bunch of people. Then COVID struck.
We suddenly discovered hundreds, if not thousands, I mean, so many people living outside of the shelters that we were unaware of.
Many of those people had been getting by before the pandemic. Like this family. The woman says her husband found steady work in construction. But those jobs have dried up. Covering rent and basic necessities is a real challenge. When you work, you have the possibility of sustaining yourself, the woman says. But without work, it's really hard. Rocky gets messages from families like hers nearly every day now.
Saying, hey, we're out of work, can you help us? Or hey, we're running low on food, can you guys help us out?
Morrison plays with the woman's three kids. Rocky swings the van doors open, revealing what looks like a scaled-down grocery store. Egg cartons stacked high, plastic bins filled with garlic, potatoes, and onions. He goes item by item.
Pasta de diente.
Toothpaste.
Aguacate.
Avocado. The woman says yes to everything. Rocky scoops black beans out of a large sack and pours them into a plastic bag. These supplies should last the family at least a week. How long they'll be in Juarez, Rocky says, is anyone's guess.
There's so many people right now who are just stuck in complete purgatory. They're not at a place they want to be, but they can't go back to where they were.
After a couple more stops, Rocky parks the van on a leafy street in downtown Juarez. A man in a soft gray shirt and baseball cap comes out of the apartment he shares with several other Cuban asylum seekers. He loads up on rice, onions, and olive oil. The man, who also asked us not to use his name because his asylum case is still open, says pre-COVID he too had an okay job in Juarez at a recycling center separating plastic. But everyone was sent home. He says he hasn't worked in months now and ended up having to sell his clothes to earn money.
A lot of people are just feeling very desperate.
Yeah, yeah.
Morrison and Rocky say the asylum seekers they've met have always found something hopeful to cling to. But with COVID continuing to spread and court postponed indefinitely, that's a lot harder.
I think a lot of people have heard that depending on how the election turns out, potentially MPP could be ended. So I think that's the biggest hope that a lot of people are really holding on to right now.
Like the Cuban asylum seeker.
Esa es la esperanza de nosotros. Que salga Biden para ver si...
Our hope is that Biden wins, that he wins and fulfills his promise. Then we'll see if we're able to cross.
Democratic candidate Joe Biden has promised to end MPP during his first 100 days in office. And if Trump is reelected...
I'll be straight with you. The idea is to get to the United States, one way or another. There might come a day when I decide to try to cross illegally, because there's no other way, and because I'm not going to stay here.
This current situation, he says, it's not sustainable for anyone. I'm Mallory Falk in Ciudad Juarez.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Remember Devo? Are We Not Men? D-E-V-O. Long about that time in a Texas of 40 years ago, a photojournalism student decided to take pictures of an explosive music scene springing up at bars near the University of Texas campus. It was a scene decidedly at odds with the general mainstream music trends. A do-it-yourself music scene with a snarl and an aesthetic reminiscent of the punk rockers of New York and London years earlier, only somehow even more subversive, rebellious, and relentless in its attack on Texas tropes. Photojournalist Pat Blaschel, who's traveled the globe documenting rock and roll, says the images of an almost forgotten music scene in Texas captures an emotional power unrivaled among his collection of images. He's gathered those impressions together in a book titled Texas is the Reason, The Mavericks of Lone Star Punk. And in it, a picture emerges of a seldom seen Texas, one of chaos and a sense of community, anger, and barely bridled aggression.
Yeah, it was loud and it was sweaty and intense. I want to be a problem. There were some very real things that people were rebelling against and sort of screaming about. These scenes are happening all over the U.S. The difference with Texas was there wasn't this, you know, intense media, news, or Hollywood or advertising industries in our town, in Austin. So it had a chance to kind of fester and grow on its own and be its own thing. And I think that that was an advantage, because then I think the scene was much more unusual and it became much more unique and diverse.
Let's talk about some of the stars of this movement. Most never really went on to be household names, although one or two did sort of emerge on the national scene. We're a family-friendly show, so I'll just refer to them as the Beehole Surfers. That was probably one. But you write that everyone sort of saw them coming in a way, right? I mean, y'all figured that this would be a big deal.
I thought they were the best band on the planet, you know, in those days. I thought that that was indisputable. They combined such a clever, thought-out concept of just shock, but also a blend of, like, noise and melody and sort of really very traditional rock elements with this punk sort of noise and energy. And there were other bands that had sort of regional reputations like Scratch Acid, Poison 13. Poison 13 is credited by a lot of the grunge musicians in Seattle as being a super big influence on them. So people like Pearl Jam, Mudhoney, Nirvana, they were all listening to the sounds from Austin.
Do you think there was something uniquely Texan about what was happening in the punk scene at Rolls and other joints? Or do you think that this was something more universal somehow?
I think there was something uniquely Texan. I think that the things that we were angry about, especially racism, the things that we were sort of trying to resist or scream about, religious conservatism, bigotry, keen awareness of some of the pressures of being in a college town with a very active and conservative Greek community. Some of the bands, they were kind of playing with the idea that Texans are these kind of backwards, slack-jawed yokels, you know, that we were hillbillies.
What's the matter, little feller? Ain't you never seen a cross-dresser before? He's queen of the barbecue. He looks much better in his dress than you. He's queen.
Many of us were artists, and we were aware and cognizant of how to put together an interesting concept in art. But we also realized that many people around the U.S. think that Texans are all crazy.
A lot of these figures that were part of this scene went on to do other things in arts and letters and music, of course. Yeah. I'm wondering, as you think about the reverberations from that little corner of the Texas capital city, how do you see the reverberations?
Well, a lot of the people that came out of our scene and our group of people, they may not have, you know, had great success or been in the New York Times. But I think of my friend Donna, who's like an excellent psychotherapist, or I think of Chris Gates, who played bass for the Big Boys, and he's now leading sobriety and 12-step meetings. And these are people, to me, that are sort of everyday heroes. And they're doing things that are, I don't know, that are just very human. They're very sort of human, wonderful, caring things that I think come out of some of what we were sort of working through and processing as we made this loud music and I made these pictures. And I don't know. I think a lot about what the musician Ian MacKay has said about punk, and he thinks that it's about being human to each other. I like that. I think that really sums it up.
It's hard to try not to imagine what this scene might be if it were possible in modern times. And yet it's impossible to imagine this reemerging in modern times because there's, you know, there's the social media outlets for the kind of angst and anxieties and pressures that a lot of young people feel even today.
Yes. Yes.
How do you think it's possible for something like this to happen somewhere, maybe even in Texas in 2020, or is this in a way a snapshot of another time when that sort of thing was impossible?
I think it's happening right now. I think it's happening in a lot of different ways, and it might look slightly different, but I just got an email from somebody who wants to talk to me about Latino punk, and he showed me some pictures that he's taking, and they look like they're made in the last few months, and it looks like at least some of them were made in New York City. And I mean, you know, it's kind of the same stuff, but you got people in a mosh pit wearing masks because there's been the lockdown. But other than that, they're like doing the same thing. So once again, it may mean that those bands are never well known, but in their town, if you want to have a good time and get sloppy and slam dance with people and have that kind of essential, vital human contact with other peoples, you can do it. I mean, you can find it. I think that, yes, social media has changed the way that sort of the broad waves of communication happen all over the world, but locally, I think this sort of stuff still happens and it's still really important to people to be able to express themselves in this way.
Pat Blaschel is the author of a new book, Texas is the Reason, The Mavericks of Lone Star Punk. He's also the photographer, and these images are truly stirring, definitely worth checking out. Pat, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. That was really fun.
Here's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. If today is Thursday, tomorrow would be the deadline for eligible Texas voters to request a mail-in ballot. Concerns and confusion about the absentee ballot process have left some voters asking, am I doing this right? As part of our statewide Texas Decides project, Texas Public Radio's Joey Palacios went looking for some answers.
Emily Deakins and her husband John decided to vote by mail for the first time because of the pandemic. Her husband has cancer, and they didn't want to take the risk of waiting in line. They dropped off their ballots in person at Houston's NRG Arena. It's the only place voters can hand-deliver a mail ballot in Harris County.
When I pulled up to the tent set up where I needed to hand in the mail-in ballot, I was approached right at the window of my car by somebody who asked for my ballot as well as my ID, my driver's license.
After dropping off their ballots, Deakins began to wonder.
My question is, why is it necessary if I drop off my mail-in ballot at a county clerk location to show my ID, whereas if I go to a post office, I can just drop my mail-in ballot into a post box?
Roxanne Werner explains. She's the director of community relations for the Harris County Clerk's Office.
That is a rule that was set up for in-person delivery by the state of Texas.
So that applies wherever you're hand-delivering a mail ballot in Texas. Here's Jackie Callinan, the elections administrator for Bexar County in San Antonio.
When they hand-deliver their ballots, they are, in fact, voting. They're handing that to an election official, much like they would in a polling place. So they are required for photo ID and to make sure that they're only delivering their ballot.
Inside the Bexar County Elections mailroom, a machine the size of a tabletop printer is mechanically folding white ballots. They'll be sent out to voters. So far, the elections office has received 61,000 completed mail ballots. That's already higher than the last presidential election. Rose Franzen is a voter in Austin who also requested a mail ballot for the first time this year. Here's her question.
My main concern is if I vote by mail, which I have my ballot already. If for some reason they don't like my signature or something else is wrong with my ballot, that I will not be notified in time to correct it and it won't count.
Both Bexar County and Harris County officials say ballot rejection is very low, but it does happen on occasion. There is a process for correction. If the signature on the ballot envelope doesn't match the signature on the mail ballot request application, Callinan says it goes under review by a group of local election judges called the Early Ballot Board.
If the Early Ballot Board has a question about that, the law allows us to go back and look at the last six signatures that we have on file from that voter. So they do their due diligence.
Earlier this week, a decision in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled Texas election officials don't have to notify voters of ballot signature errors until after the election is over. Counties can do it voluntarily, though. Callanan says her office in Bexar County does that.
Our staff here does an amazing job. And if we get ballots in now that people did not sign across the back, we're sending them back to them and saying, please sign it. We don't want them to be disenfranchised.
Roxanne Warner says Harris County does the same.
We will make an attempt to contact you and let you know what your other options are. So if there is a chance to rectify that, or if it needs to be canceled and you can vote in person, we will make every attempt on our end to let the voter know that.
One final note. If you have a mail ballot and change your mind and want to vote in person, you can. Just bring your blank ballot to the poll so election officials can destroy it. If you forget it at home, you can still vote at the polling site using a provisional ballot. I'm Joy Palacios in San Antonio.
This story is part of the statewide series Texas Decides. You can find the answers to other voter questions at texasdecides.org. And while you're there, you can get a personalized ballot to help you cast your own vote. And you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, proud to be a founding sponsor of the Texas Standard on public radio. Texas Mutual is a policyholder-owned workers' comp provider working to bring wellness into the workplace. More at texasmutual.com.
Wells Dunbar is monitoring the Talk of Texas on this Thursday. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. Well, as we just heard in that previous story, lots of folks anxious about getting their vote in and getting it counted, specifically with some of these vote-by-mail issues. As an example, I see this comment from Facebook from Brent Davey. Brent says, I keep looking at the signature on my driver's license and wondering if it matched my mail-in ballot. He jokes that I needed a new source of anxiety because 2020 has been much too chill. I think I detect a little sarcasm there. But obviously, as we heard in that story from Joy Palacios, questions over the ability of these election officials to reject ballots. Although, as you and I have discussed, David, it seems to be a relatively minor thing that we've heard scant about until this election season. Of course, one way to circumvent that is just by voting in person, and that's what Deborah Farrell says she did. She says she's already voted early today, so hats off to her for beating the crowds there early in the morning. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, it's just hard to think about, you know, what else, you know, I put out a pretty open call on our Facebook page earlier, you know, mm-hmm. what are people talking about? And it's really hard to, you know, hard to see much else there other than this election, which is just barreling at us full speed ahead. The last presidential debate tonight.
Well, there are some other stories, that's for sure, making news in Texas. Mm-hmm. I took a look at the Houston Chronicle a few minutes ago, and they have quite a takeout on how the oil industry there is consolidating, and it is expected to leave behind a much smaller oil and gas industry mm-hmm. with far fewer players employing far fewer workers. And the summary from the Houston Chronicle is that this is very bad news for Houston in the larger sense because it's been such an economic engine. Right. The question, of course, is what comes next? So there are a lot of other stories other than politics, but it's my understanding that tonight at the debate, and we talked about that a little earlier in the broadcast, mm-hmm. energy and the environment are supposed to be topics. We'll see if anyone will be staying
on
topic.
We'll see how closely they queue
right.
to all that stuff.
Right.
But again, and we saw that a lot in the vice presidential debate with Kamala Harris. Basically taking this pro-fracking position, almost you might say sort of baited into that, because I did see some objection from the left to this sort of stance where Mike Pence was saying, you know, they want to ban fracking. She was saying, no, that is not the case. We are in support of it as one of our energy sources. So obviously, I expect we'll see a little bit more back and forth over disinformation like that at tonight's debate as well. Well, you know, just shifting gears briefly, I have to say, the one other thing that's on folks' minds is, believe it or not, some actual seasonal weather for most parts of Texas. Barbara Stansfield Terry says she's concerned with just how far south that cold front's going to make it next week, how cold it will be, and whether or not it meets the test of having to lug the plants inside. Yeah, looking here, it looks like we might get down to like the 40s by Tuesday here in the capital.
Someone was
city.
Mentioning something I'm not sure I've ever heard of. It's called a jacket.
Yeah.
The J-A-C-K-E-T. I hear that they're popular up north. In any event, we're out of time for the big broadcast. The news continues over at texasstandard.org. And, of course, we'll be back here tomorrow. We hope you can join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells, Dunbar, and the rest of the team, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.